art with you.
That's okay. Okay, you hear me now? I feel like the commercial. Okay, money is more than 50% of my life. What in the world am I talking about there? Well, let's see if we can get this working. Okay. We talk about our interest in money, and you know, just from the very fact of how much time we have to put into our jobs. If you take the 16-hour day, and I just picked a couple arbitrary numbers, I don't know what time you get up, but 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., 16 hours times 5 days a week is 80 hours. If you work a 40-hour week, what's that? 50% of your time. That doesn't include travel time and all the other stuff, and especially if you're working more than that, you could be all of a sudden up to 70% of your time without batting an eye. And all of a sudden, making, spending, and managing money is a pretty big chunk of our lives, isn't it? Whether we like it or not, there it is. It also contributes to a lot of relational conflicts in varying intensities, simple difference of opinion to murder. You know, people have gotten killed over money. You know that. You hear it in the news. Not very far. Just Milwaukee and all over the place, people are getting killed for money. When you think about the upset in relational conflict because of debt, you know, whatever kind of debt it is, there can be conflict over that. Personalities within marriage or relationships, some people are spenders and the other people are what? Savers. Okay, you get that combination together, you could have some conflict. And then there's the power play stuff or the control. Someone's employed and somebody's not employed, and whoever, it's kind of the golden rule. The one who has the gold makes the rules. You know, that comes into conflict. Okay. And then there's the mine, yours, and ours. You know, the two spouses have incomes, and how do we sort stuff out to pay the bills? And you know, what's left over? Is that ours? Is that mine? You know, how does that all work out? And children, you know, children are expensive. In fact, it costs now nearly $300,000 to raise a child for 18 years. Now, do I look like somebody who had a $1.2 million to raise my four kids? I don't think so. I'm not sure where they got their numbers, but anyway, it causes conflict. So we're talking about money not only taking a big chunk of our time, but also a real potential for conflict within marriage. And then there's stress, isn't there? You know, because if we don't have money, the price is too high, the quality is too low, we don't have enough, or injustice, you wind up with worry, anger, or bitterness. And so this is just a little bit of our interest in the... Okay. When you talk about God's interest, over 2,300 verses in the Bible are talking about our possessions or our material things, our money. About a third of Jesus' parables talk about money. That's a surprising figure to some of you, maybe. So there's a big chunk of time. And it is a spiritual testing ground. God says it over and over again. That heart-treasure link, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. That is a hardwired link. It is a non-negotiable. And unless we come to grips with that, we really don't understand. God is using our treasure, our money, the fact of our working days to allow us to be a test to our faith. Now, let's just catch up where we are. We are here. We're in a Proverbs series. If you've missed something, you can catch it online. The sermons are online generally. And we have been looking at Proverbs in the sense of values, character qualities, behavioral things that are great to emulate or to follow. They're the template that we want to live. It's all about wisdom for living. How do we take the Bible and apply it to our lives in a very practical way? But it also tells us about what I call red flag people, attitudes, people as well, and actions to avoid like the chicken pox. You don't want to be by these people. You just steer clear. It is just not worth the hassle and the difficulty of being around these people. Now let's take two observations about money that we should understand, that money possesses two inherent dangers. And the first one is that money is a deceiver. What do I mean by that? I mean that it promises things it can't deliver. It promises security. You know, the 401k, you know, a lot of people, including myself, you know, took quite a hit when the stock market went down a number of years ago. Chapter 20, Chapter 23 in Proverbs, it says, "Don't weary yourself to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration of it, for when you set your eyes on it, it's gone. For wealth certainly makes itself wings like an eagle that flies toward heavens." Any of you ever heard the phrase, "money talks"? Mine says goodbye. I don't know about you. That's usually what I hear. Wings like the eagles that flies towards heavens. The security is not there. We can pile it up, and then you have a phrase like this by Donald Trump: "Whoever says money can't buy happiness doesn't know where to shop." Oh, really? Okay. Direct quote. We stop and think about things that money promises that it can't deliver. It doesn't bring peace. It doesn't bring happiness. It doesn't bring friends. It doesn't bring security. And the list could go on and on. Remember, counterfeit bills are not purple. Satan is a deceiver, and he will use money to deceive us. It will promise things that it cannot deliver, and yet we go after it time and time again. The other thing is, another problem or inherent danger is that money is an intoxicating drug. Now, this is interesting as well, because drugs tend to dull our senses in some ways, and having a lot of money, the book of Proverbs says the rich man answers roughly, or he's harsh with people. Because he's got money, he thinks he has power, and he can just kind of walk all over people, and people are the doormats. You've seen that, I'm sure, or arrogance or pride. So it dulls our feelings toward others. It also excites, in another way, the drive or the hunt for more. Some time ago, I came across a little story called Fortune and the Beggar. One day, a ragged beggar was creeping from house to house. He carried an old bag wallet in his hand, and he was asking at every door for a few cents to buy something to eat. He kept wondering why it was that so many folks had so much money, and they were never satisfied, but always wanting more. Here he said this, "The master of the house, I know him well. He's always a good businessman. He took to building ships and sending them to sea to trade in foreign lands. He thought he would get mountains of gold. But there was a great storm on the water, and his ships were wrecked, and his riches were swallowed up by the waves. Men never seem to be satisfied unless they can gain the whole world. As for me, if I only had enough to eat and something to wear, I would not want for any more." Just at that time, Fortune came walking down the street. She saw the beggar and stopped and said to him, "Listen, I've longed for a long time to help you. Hold out your wallet and I will pour this gold into your wallet. I will pour it only on this condition, that all that falls in the wallet will be pure gold, and anything that falls on the ground will become dust." The beggar was so glad, he opened his bag wallet and the yellow coins began to pour in. And the bag began to grow heavy. "Is that enough?" asked Fortune. "Ah, not enough. Not yet. As if the golden stream would only pour forever," said the beggar. "You're the richest man in the world now. The wallet is full. It will burst. Just a little more. Just a handful more," said the beggar. "Just a little more." Another piece was added and the wallet split, and the treasure all fell to the ground and was turned to dust. And he had nothing but his empty bag wallet, now torn from top to bottom, and he was poor as he was before. You see, the hunt for more can cause us a problem. But that's what the intoxicating work of money does. It drives us. It excites our affections. Look at what Paul told Timothy as he... let's see. Did I lose that one? Yep. Let me back that up a minute. Yep. 1 Timothy chapter 6. You want to quickly turn back there. You know, you come to Grace Bible Church, your Bibles are going to get a workout, aren't they? Chapter 6. I'm going to begin reading at verse 7. For we brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these shall we shall be content. Ah, boy, that's a tough one, isn't it? Contentment. Do you have that contentment, or do you have that agitated feeling? It's kind of that thing in the pit of your stomach or in your heart that just agitates for more and something. Paul says, but those who want to get rich, notice the stack of words he uses. Those that want to get rich, that drive, that excitement, that hunt for more, fall into temptation and a snare, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. You know, temptation's not good. It's not necessarily sin in itself, but it moves you that way. A snare is something you get trapped in. I mean, some of you hunters know what snares are. You get trapped. You can't see the snare, right? Unless we're sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, and maybe you're thinking to myself, Paul, you're preaching to the choir. This isn't going to happen to me. There, you are a fool. You're in more danger than anybody thinking it can't happen to you. It can happen to any of us. We can get tricked. If money is a deceitful thing, if it is an intoxicating drug, we can get tricked. Paul is not using words lightly here. He says, for the love of money, not money itself, but the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith, pierced themselves with many a pang or problem. So it's an intoxicating drug that dulls and excites. It also drives us and clouds us. I'm going to go back to 2 Kings chapter 5, a story that maybe some of you know and our boys and girls probably know from Sunday school about Elisha healing the Syrian general Naaman of his leprosy. But I'm going to go to the end and talk about Gehazi. Gehazi was Elisha's servant. Elisha didn't charge Naaman for his ministry of healing. This was a priceless thing to go from being a leprosy and having this dreaded disease to being completely well, being able to be around his family again. And Gehazi was upset with this. In verse 20 it says, behold, my master spared Naaman the Syrian by not receiving from his hands what he brought. Naaman wanted to pay him, and Elisha said no. Gehazi thinks, as the Lord lives, I'll run after him and take something from him. Gehazi pursued Naaman. When Naaman saw him, the one running after him, he came down from the chariot, and he said, let me get that next one up there. And he said, is all well? Gehazi said, all is well. Now, count the lies. My master has sent me, saying, behold, just now two young men from the sons of the prophets have come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of clothes. Naaman said, please take two talents of silver. And he urged him and bound two talents of silver in two bags and two changes of clothes. He gave them to two of his servants, and they carried him before him. Now, lest we think that this is a little amount, a talent was 75 pounds. So we're talking 150 pounds of silver. That's why the servants carried him and not Gehazi. You want to tuck 150 pounds of silver under your arm and walk home with it? Okay, do you see the lies? First of all, he deceived himself. Secondly, he told two lies to Naaman. And now he gets home, puts him in the house, and he goes his way. In verse 25, he went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said to him, where have you been, Gehazi? Gehazi said, your servant went nowhere. Lie number three. Elisha said to him, did not my heart go with you when the man turned from his chariot to greet you or to meet you? Is it a time to receive money, to receive clothes, olive yards, vineyards, keep sheep, oxen, male and female servants? I think he was telling you, Gehazi, there's a time to be paid. This wasn't it. Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cleave to you and your descendants forever. And he went from out of his presence, a leper as white as snow. He deceived himself, he deceived Naaman, he deceived Elisha, and he hurt his family, didn't he? Why? Because of the drive for money. He thought he was doing the right thing. He thought, what? That famous last words, "I can get away with this." You ever say that to yourself? Maybe not in so many words, but and maybe you didn't think it through, but you thought it, haven't you? "I've done the same thing. I can get away with this." No, you can't. Elisha knew it as if God had just told him. I believe God did. Gehazi didn't get by with it. Money drove him. You know, zookeepers handle deadly snakes carefully. Chefs handle pots and pans, hot pots and pans, carefully. Tradesmen use dangerous tools with skill and respect. And we have to have the same respect for our money. We have to handle it carefully in our own attitudes and our values and all the things that we talk about. Now, when we work for money, we usually call it income. Income can take a variety of ways. It could be an inheritance. It could be from our work. It can be a gift. It can be many things. So we're going to take some principles about income this morning. And these probably aren't found in some of your money books because they're strictly taken from the book of Proverbs. We're going to take a number of verses this morning. And the first thing we want to do is get the great general principle out of chapter 10 and verse 22, where Solomon tells us that it is the blessing of the Lord that makes rich, and he adds no sorrow to it. When we are making money, if we're becoming more wealthy, God is not the one who's adding sorrow to it. If the sorrow is coming, maybe we need to back up and say, what's this all about, this emotional upheaval with the wealth? You know, we're talking about that. How do we get it? What are we doing with it? What's our attachment to it? Is it cause for stress? Maybe God doesn't want us to have it as well. When we talk about rich as compared to who, we're all rich. You look at the other portions of the world where people are living on less than a dollar a day for a year, for all of their life. It's amazing. What we have here in your pocket today, we've got more wealth in our pocket than some countries would have for their year's wages. You know, 55% of people who have assets of $1 million to $5 million don't consider themselves wealthy. I'd be glad to help them out, wouldn't you? Oh boy, isn't that amazing? What we think in relative terms. Let's turn a page or two to chapter 12. As we look at what God says about work, the general principle is that God is the one who makes rich without sorrow. Now let's get into some of the details. Here is one, that diligent work meets needs. Look at verse 11 of chapter 12. It says, "He who tills his land will have plenty of bread, but," here's a contrast, "he who pursues vain things will lack sense." If we're off chasing pipe dreams, Solomon says we lack sense. It's the diligent, the one who tills his land on a regular basis and does what he needs to do in relation to work, is the one who's going to get ahead. It's the long haul attitude. It's the diligence. It's the care. It's not the flash in the pan. It's not hurried. It is showing up for work every day and doing a good job is what this is all about. Works with a diligent hand. In chapter 14, verse 23, another verse that I have up there for you, it says, "In all labor there is profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty." Here's the doing, the labor, leading to profit, and the contrast to that is talking about it. Well, I'm going to do, and you've heard that 10 times, and you've heard that 40 times, haven't you? Haven't you heard people say that? "I'm going to do," and it never gets done. "I'm going to do this," and it never gets done. "I'm going to do this," and it never gets done. We're not just talking about the honey-do list, okay? We're talking about the plans, the lifestyle of people who only talk and never get around to working. So diligence, working on a regular basis, is the thing that is going to help us meet the needs that we have. Might not make us rich, but it will last a lifetime if we just show up for work every day and we do a good job as unto the Lord, the kind of work that you would want done for you if you were the employer. And here's another proverb out of chapter 13 and verse 18. It says, poverty and shame will come to him who neglects discipline, and literally the word is instruction. And then there's a contrast word, but he who regards reproof will be honored. If you want to get ahead, you need to be teachable. You need to learn from somebody correcting you. Notice the contrast here. Poverty and shame comes to the one who neglects discipline or instruction. The people who neglect instruction are the ones that are too good to learn, thinks he knows it all, doesn't follow direction, doesn't need the directions. Okay? You know people like that. You work with some of these people. And kind of aggravating sometimes, isn't it? But on the other hand, the one who regards reproof, in other words, accept personal responsibility for what's going on and says, yep, you're right, I made a mistake. You know, there are people who don't accept reproof, don't take any personal responsibility. Instead, they blame somebody else or something else. It's not my fault. It's never my fault. You know, I'll find 100 things to blame before I'll take responsibility for it. You know people like that too? Probably. It's interesting how practical Proverbs is when it comes right down to it. And that's a principle that we need to really take to heart, that if we are going to have income, God wants us not only to be diligent, but also able to be taught, to learn. And sometimes we need to learn things from people that we might not necessarily like to learn from. Maybe somebody younger, less experienced, may have a good idea about something that we can learn from. And then there's hard work. Be honest. Honest work, honest tongue, honest standards, honest claims, honest materials. Even when people can't see it, do we have a sense of honesty? Chapter 15, verse 27. What's it say? He who profits illicitly troubles his own house, but he who hates bribes will live. A shady dealer, somebody who is not doing something right and profiting by it, actually does what? Troubles his own house. Chapter 21 and verse 6, it says, the getting of treasures by a lying tongue is a fleeting vapor, a pursuit of death. Now, you've lived in Wisconsin long enough that when you go out in the fall, you breathe out and you see this little puff of white. That's that vapor, that little moisture that you see. And that disappears pretty quickly, doesn't it? Doesn't stick around. That's what Solomon is talking about here. If we're getting treasures by misrepresenting something, it's like a fleeting vapor. It's the pursuit of death. And, you know, money often touches relationships. Relationships are built on trust. And if you mess up in money with somebody, you might have toasted your trust. Whether it's in marriage or work or school or fundraisers or any time you're handling money, it's a trust relationship with somebody. And if we're profiting illicitly or we're lying about something, we are headed in the wrong direction. Proverbs 20 and verse 23 says, differing weights are an abomination to the Lord. A false scale is not good. Now, we don't use those balance scales anymore, but back in the Bible times, if a person wanted to cheat somebody, instead of having a bushel for a measure, maybe he'd only have 7/8 of a bushel if he was selling something, but you'd certainly want the whole bushel if you were buying something, wouldn't you? And people would be able to cheat by altering their weights. And God says, listen, I hate that kind of stuff. If you're going to be measuring something, let it be honest. In fact, it would be better to be a little bit over and give them a little bit more than to take a little bit less in that respect. So the idea of buying and selling is important to be honest there. Chapter 20 and verse 17 What does it say there? Bread obtained by falsehood is sweet to a man. You know, we go and say, we may have lied about something and we've acquired something and we feel like it's a sweet deal, but then afterward his mouth is filled with gravel. It turns to sand. No, it's not so good after all. When Marcia and I were in Texas, when I was in school, we were poor seminary students and we were always looking for a bargain. And where I worked, I heard some guys were talking about getting these chunks of beef or ham, and it sounded like a good price, so I gave somebody $10 and I had a nice big piece of roast beef. It looked like it came out of a deli. Well, later on, I heard that this was hot meat. And I don't mean warm in the sense of out of the oven. Somebody was setting it out in the back and somebody was picking it up, and all of a sudden we didn't enjoy it quite as much knowing that. We didn't ask it too many more questions and we never did that again, but you know, it just kind of brought this verse back to mind as I did that. We did it innocently. I mean, I had no idea, or I would have never done that. But you know, sometimes when we receive something by falsehood, you know, the joy of it turns to gravel pretty quickly. And we thought we were doing the right thing by getting a good deal. Didn't happen that way. You know, false claims, not disclosing something when we're selling it, the fine print. Boy, you know, one of those struggles for me is how much do I tell them about my car that I'm selling? You ever had that struggle? You know, you want to know everything about the car you're buying, but the car you're selling, maybe you don't say as much about it. And the fine print on the contract. I was changing insurances, and the thing that came to me was the accidental death life insurance. Well, you know, you read the fine print, and you'd have to die on the second Tuesday of the week under a full moon and between 3 and 4 in the morning, and, you know, a taxi would have to run over you. You know, and it was just nonsense. You know, and people make claims, and you see this in products and various things. We really need to have an honest spirit when we talk about stuff and what we do. You know, the bottom line in income is honest in, honest out. We need to preserve our integrity, that people can look in our lives, look through us and say, you know, there's nothing there to hang any charges on. You know, if you have a clear conscience, that's important. And honoring God is important as well. We certainly would never want to hear, oh, you're a Christian and you did that? You know, that's a bad testimony. You know, people would, you know, we're toast for a long time because of that trust issue when it comes to misrepresenting something or saying we're a Christian and not following through with our lifestyle. You know, when we trust Christ as our Savior, Jesus can change our business attitude, our way of handling money. You look at Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus wasn't saved for very long. He was a tax collector. Most people hated him because of that particular profession he was in. And what did he tell Jesus? He said, I'll give half my possessions to the poor. He was ready to get rid of most of the money. He said, if I defrauded anybody, if I misrepresented my assessment for their taxes that they paid me, I'll give them back fourfold. Now, what a change in the man's life. He was ready to clear his conscience in a big way and get stuff straightened out with God and with everybody else. It was really an amazing story about that. And then a fourth principle, that the combination of hurry and money generally spells trouble, doesn't it? You ever find that true? Well, let's read the verse, chapter 20, and or chapter 28, and verse 20. It says, a faithful man will abound with blessings, but he who makes haste or hurries to be rich will not go unpunished. Good verse. Faithfulness has a track record. In other words, it's something that takes place over time. You don't get it quickly. It's an evidential diligence. It's able to be trusted because of the history. One good decision doesn't make you a faithful person. One of the godly men in my life many years ago was a man by the name of Ed Nanfelt. He was an elder in one of our in the churches that I attended, a godly man. He didn't have a lot of education, but he was a very godly man. He started out as a glass blower and then later founded the U.S. Fused Quartz Company, where they made all sorts of scientific beakers and flasks and all sorts of stuff for laboratory glass. It was some sort of fused quartz. Started out as a glassblower, very kind of a lowly profession. I don't think it was one of these high-end glassblowing type jobs. But because of faithfulness and not in a hurry, he was a very generous man. And his brother was a fishmonger, I think they call him in New York City. He peddled fish. They had to clean the fish. They'd cut the heads and tails off and gut the fish, and they'd put them on ice, and he'd go and peddle these fish in New York. Well, what do you do with all the heads and the guts and the tails? He realized that mink really enjoyed fish. He started a mink farm, and his mink were some of the best in the United States back when mink was a high commodity for furs. A long time ago, these brothers became very wealthy men. But you know, it was very poor beginnings, very diligent, very faithful, honored the Lord with the first of their wealth. They did all the things that Proverbs talks about, but it wasn't get rich quick. It was a slow thing. Have you ever heard that get rich quick phrase? You know, get rich quick. You know, money and hurry don't often go together well. It usually spells trouble. You know, the phrase is often associated with schemes and scams. It's not a way to be blessed by God. Our desire to get rich quick, we may often fall into schemes and scams. They may be completely legal, but the thing may be oversold to us, and how much you can make, how easy it is. You know, you've heard that through multi-level marketing and other things like that. I'm sure you know the groups to get income. Or the scheme may be illegal scams, lotteries, gambling, sly people, deceiving, badgering, threatening. My mother lost in excess of $20,000 to the Canadian lottery goofs. And they actually, on the phone, became very threatening to her. She was fearful of not giving these guys money. Fortunately, one of my sisters was able to find out what was going on and intervene. But, you know, just to lose in excess of $20,000. Now, my mom was in her 80s. Things were kind of heading downhill a little bit as far as her memory and judgment went. And I would suggest to you, if you've got older relatives, keep track of them. And if you are an older person, you need to have somebody checking in with you, or at least you don't have to show them all your finances, but at least run it by somebody to say, where's the check on this? You know, am I doing the right thing by giving to these people? You know, this came through the phone, not the mail. You know, you can throw the garbage in, but if somebody's threatening you on the phone to give you money and you've got to give them money, you know, that becomes a little scarier. You know, these people were going to show up on my mother's doorstep and get the money from her. So it was very frightening in a big way. So be careful. I'm grateful that she didn't have a computer. You've heard of phishing, P-H-I-S-I-N-G, or whatever the spelling is. Yeah, dangerous stuff. Be careful of that. Don't let your money out of your hands. You know, very few financial decisions need to be made on the spot. Let's see, proven track record, get rich quick. Oh, yes, and here's the other one. Important financial decisions. Very few need to be made on the spot. How many of you ever heard that phrase? You got to act now. You know, if you don't send in your money, you know, in the next 20 minutes, we'll take the first 10 callers, you know, and all that stuff. Well, years ago, I made a decision. Marsh and I went to a vending business spiel. And, you know, with my talking her into it, we got into something. And I violated, you know, the principles I'm going to share with you now. Of not praying, not doing some research, not talking about it further, and not sleeping on it. That was the big thing. You know, if you don't have the time to make the decision, maybe you shouldn't make it. And that ranks right up there in getting into this business of one of the three dumbest things I've ever done in my life. And if you're interested in the other two, see me later. Oh, boy. And it was all my fault. I mean, we didn't lose our shirt over it, but it just ranks up there as one of the dumb things I've done. But I violated the principle. We weren't trying to hurry to get rich, but I violated the principle of making the decision in a hurry. And we've been very careful ever since. You know, if you're married, you need to set a figure that we don't spend above this figure without talking to each other and thinking about it, praying about it, doing some research, and sleeping on it, so that, you know, the Lord's got time to confirm to us what we need to have confirmed. And those are important things. So let's review. God blesses us through a variety of sources. You probably don't have a money tree in your backyard. And work and riches come through diligence, the long haul, the honesty, the faithfulness, the wise decisions, checking with somebody about stuff, just to run it by them. You know, as we deal with money, a lot of times our emotions get cranked up. You find something you really want to do, and you lose objectivity. And there's where talking to some other people about what you're doing is always a good help. And we've got some experienced and wise men in our congregation who've done well in being objective sounding boards. Now, bottom line that I want to leave with you this morning, we're going to talk about money a little bit more in the future, but today's bottom line is that, you know, a lot of your income and a lot of your bank account really doesn't reflect how rich you really are. You know, if you've been faithfully sending money on ahead to heaven by your investments in God's kingdom and various things, and you've been generous and you've been gracious, you might not have a big bank account, but you may be wealthier than most of the richest people in the world. You may be much happier as well. So keep in mind that what we see does not really determine our wealth, our riches. Okay? Now, maybe you've got some decisions to make this morning, and I'm not going to ask you to share your dumb decisions, but maybe you need to say something to God that if you need to clean house and get some stuff straightened out and get back on the right financial track, would you do that? Father in heaven, we thank you so much for the practicality of your word. We pray that your spirit might be working in our lives, that we would just be able to take these verses from Proverbs and apply them to us. Help us to be an encouragement to one another in the area of godliness and honesty and faithfulness. Father, help us to exhort one another daily, lest we be trapped by the deceitfulness of sin. Father, help us to be cautious about what we do, what we invest in, what we give, to whom we give. And Father, that we would just continue to see your blessings. Thank you for the way that you bless us corporately as a church. And we're very grateful for the sound financial principles that we've been able to operate with for these many years. I pray that we would not only do that as a congregation, but also that we would see it in our lifestyles and in individual families and teenagers and children, and that we might continue to sense your blessings. That we would be generous people, that we would be conduits of your blessings to others. In Jesus' name, amen.